I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jonathan Alter has a new book. I always look forward to his books because he's a very thoughtful writer and he knows the backstory of what's going on so many different fronts. The book is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. He writes actually the first sentence of the book. Since graduating from college in 1979, he's covered 9 presidential elections, which he says may qualify him as a masochist. Every 4 years, at least one candidate piously claims that this election is the most important of our lifetimes. He says it was never true until 2012. This looks at all kinds of issues. It examines, well, it asks the questions, what would happen if Obama were more of a schmoozer, which is an interesting question. It looks at the Tea Party and asks the question, what is behind the sense of outrage? It examines the way the president has been governing. He governs above the fray. It looks at his intense racial consciousness, which is manifested perhaps more in private than it is in public. It looks at partisanship, intense partisanship, issues of race, and, well, so many different issues in Jonathan's book. Jonathan Alter, of course, he is a political analyst. He's written several other books, The Promise, President Obama Year One, and The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. They were both New York Times bestsellers. He's a columnist for Bloomberg View, analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. He's been a senior editor for Newsweek, where he was for 28 years, also written for The Times, The Post, The Washington Monthly, The Atlantic, and The List Goes On. We will be welcoming phone calls as we speak with Jonathan Alter. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jonathan Alter, hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I think you're a heck of a writer. You are analyzing so many different issues that the book is fascinating because you're talking about race and healthcare reform and the Tea Party and various personalities and how they're interacting. You really have your eyes in a lot of places, don't you?
Well, I did try to cover a lot of ground. I wanted this to be more than just a campaign book.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to put our national experience of the last couple of years in some kind of historical context, and also tell people the fun stuff, you know, the juicy things that are going on behind closed doors. Not juicy in a, you know, sexual way, but you know, sort of like pull back the curtain, use my reporting that I've done with a couple hundred different sources in both parties to give people a sense of what it's like when the door is closed.
Right. And you start the book, I just referenced the fact that you thought that this election may have been the most important of our lifetimes. People say that about every election. Why is 2012 the one?
Well, they do say it. And, in all those elections I've covered, I'd always see some candidate piously saying, you know, this is the most important election of my lifetime. And
right.
It was because they were running, you know. So I don't think, for instance, just to take, you know, an example of a reelection campaign, when Bill Clinton was running against Bob Dole in 1996, it was not the most important election. Bob Dole, whose health care plan at that time, by the way, was the model for Obamacare. For anybody out there who thinks that Obamacare is a socialist, you know, radical plan, it was the Bob Dole, Howard Baker health care plan from the early 1990s. And if Dole had won, I don't think the United States would have undergone cataclysmic change. But if Romney had won in 2012, the country would have swung very sharply to the right, or at least the government of the country. This is not your father's Republican Party. So one of the things I tried to, you know, to do in this book was to explain some of the roots of how we got to this strange path. Somebody like Grover Norquist, for instance,
mm-hmm.
who I've known since college. We were college classmates.
Oh, were you?
He developed a stranglehold over our political process with his famous pledge. And so I needed to, you know, for my own curiosity and for my own understanding, and I hope the reader's understanding of the period, to explain, you know, how that party became what can only be described as a radical party, and by contrast, how the Democrats became almost a small-c conservative party, and by conservative I mean that what was at stake in this election was conserving, protecting, defending the progressive accomplishments of the 20th century. And these were accomplishments, whether it's, you know, Medicare, Social Security, aid to education, building infrastructure. These were accepted by Democrats and Republicans until the election of 2010, when you suddenly had a crowd that was, you know, ready to roll all this back in a big way, and Mitt Romney, you know, ran as the head of that party, never once repudiated Rush Limbaugh or any of the rest of them, to suggest that he would chart an independent course, and if he had won, it would have validated all of what they had put forward, and also their philosophy of government and the role of government in our society. So just imagine, Kathleen, for a minute, to do a little thought experiment, that Romney had won, the economy is now doing quite a bit, at least somewhat better. So what would the lesson have been that would have been drawn were Romney and Ryan in office right now? It would be that, you know, slashing taxes again for the wealthy, as they proposed, slashing regulation much more deeply, slashing social programs, applying kind of an Ayn Rand spirit to government. And, of course, Ayn Rand is Paul Ryan's inspiration in public life, as those in Wisconsin are well aware. What would the lesson of that been? Well, if you do all that, then the economy grows. There would have been a cause and effect, and it would have discredited progressive ideas for a generation. So my, you know, my message, I guess, to progressives who might be listening right now is, I understand why people are frustrated at this moment, but I would urge them to look at the glass half full and just think about what things would be like right now were Romney and Ryan getting credit for the recent economic growth, and Obama kind of condemned to the dustbin of history as another Jimmy Carter and a fluke.
Yeah, interesting. Let's. We'll get to, and you have fascinating information about very conservative talk show hosts, and the chapters on Fox are just fascinating. We'll get to those. But I want to start with health care, because many have said it's the signature achievement and may indeed be of the entire two terms of the president. You write some very interesting things about this, and you suggest that had Democrats been better able to sell health care reform, they may not have lost the House in 2010. And then finding a Wisconsin guy who figures, you know, in a little part of this book, but I hadn't thought about him in a while, Steve Kagan from Appleton, Wisconsin, congressman who lost his seat in 2010, but begging the president to talk about health care and the freedoms that we would have as a result of it, and the freedoms that he should have outlined. It brings together a whole bunch of issues, the way the president may govern, the way he talks, the way Republicans get the communication message. But what this is a dramatic thing to say. If they had been better able to sell health care, maybe they wouldn't have suffered the defeats of 2010.
I think that's right. It's very hard, you know, with what ifs, because the unemployment rate was about 10% during for Democrats, disastrous midterms in 2010, which set the stage for everything that followed. The shellacking, as the president called it, gave them a bunch of state legislatures that allowed them to not just redraw congressional lines, so that locking in Republican control of the House until the next census, but also allowed them to pass voter suppression legislation in 19 states. But on the health care point, yeah, I have a scene with former Congressman Kagan where he goes to the White House, and he's a doctor, and he's thought deeply about these issues, an early Obama supporter, and he gives them a kind of a frame in which to sell in language that's very easy, would have been very easy for people to understand about why the Affordable Care Act, or what now everybody agrees can be called Obamacare, you know, was essentially an act of freedom and giving people a lot of freedom from not just the worry that they would lose their house if they got sick, but the freedom to have ways of fighting back against insurance companies and against, you know, those who limited their options. And I think Kagan's point was that, you know, maybe my way of framing it, and he had a whole sort of interesting take on the whole thing, maybe that's not the right way, he said to the White House. But you guys can do better than you have in selling this,
right,
in formulating a compelling argument. And it was almost as if they didn't try after the bill was signed in March of 2010. For the rest of that year, they didn't really put out much of an effort. Instead, they, you know, kept changing the subject and almost assumed that having been signed, the bill would become more popular, and instead it became less popular. And there was very little effort to use the Obama army from 2008 to fight against the Tea Party. And there were a series of other mistakes in communications in that period that helped set the stage for a disastrous 2011 for the president.
Why doesn't the president get that sound bites, as you remind us, were used by Abraham Lincoln, they were used by FDR, they're part of modern politics, and they may serve him well. He doesn't want to use them.
I think he thinks that sound bites are kind of phony and artificial, and that that being genuine is the calling card for this particular president, that he's not just another politician spouting lines. And so instead he speaks in often eloquent paragraphs, but not in those sound bites that linger in the mind and that can help drive the arguments.
Right.
Because people can't remember whole paragraphs, but they can remember one lines. And as you mentioned, you know, going back to Lincoln, you could say that Jesus Christ spoke in sound bites. And so this is something that has puzzled me about this president for many years. You know, I knew him. I'm from Chicago originally, and I knew him when he was a state senator. And, you know, I remember when he was first even running for the U.S. Senate, and I noticed that he rejected what he thought of as the artificiality of politics. And in some ways, that's commendable, but it also has a way of getting him into trouble, as we saw in that first debate when he kind of had a disdain for the theater of politics, the requirements of politics that he thinks don't have anything to do with job of president. He might be right that having a, you know, a 30-second answer in a debate doesn't really have anything to do with being the day-to-day job of being president, but he forgets that the presidency is a theater. It has always been a theater, and I think he also sometimes ignores advice that comes from what he says is his favorite movie, The Godfather. Remember Hyman Roth in The Godfather?
Right.
This is the business we have chosen, you know. And sometimes I think he's forgotten that politics is the business he's chosen. So he ends up leaving a tool in the toolbox that, you know, massaging, stroking of other politicians, of business leaders, and other leaders. And he does some of it, but arguably not enough. Although I do have to say that I think that is of lesser importance than the just rank obstruction of his adversaries and his enemies.
And as you say, when he is good, he is extraordinary. When he gave the race speech, when he spoke before Congress, there are times when you think nobody can do this much better.
Yeah, I think that's right. And he also rises to the occasion, and he likes to get the ball and hit the jump shot at the buzzer. And so you saw the way he came back in the second and third debates. And what I try to do in the center holds is to, you know, not rehash the debates that everybody saw, but take people into the prep room and explain, you know, what happened to him in prep before that first debate, where he was actually 0-for-6 in mock debates with John Kerry, who was playing Mitt Romney. And then the way he, in the prep for the second debate, he laid a trap for Romney on Benghazi, which ended up working out well for him.
It sure did. Well, let's talk about the opposition. You talk about the Tea Party being formed 3 weeks after Obama took office. You asked the question, what's the answer? What lay behind the sense of outrage?
Well, you know, I'm often asked, I want to kind of start with the racial point, because, you know, I'm often asked, isn't this all just racism? And my answer would be no. I don't think it's fair to say that everybody who despises Barack Obama does so for reasons that have a racial dimension. But there's no question that some of them do have a kind of a racial component to their hatred. And for some people, it's not race. It's a kind of a threatening sense of otherness about him, and the exotic almost quality of him, that you know, if you grew up in a different America, he is the face of the change that you fear. And he embodies everything that seems to be changing so fast and in such a disorienting way, and the demographic changes in the United States. But it also has to be said that there has been intense opposition to, you know, every president. And so there were people who thought that Bill Clinton was a murderer.
Right.
And so this goes back to what they said about Thomas Jefferson and his slave mistress in the election of 1800. So some of this is, you know, in a familiar context. But what's different is that what was called Bush derangement syndrome, which referred to people called truthers who believed that Bush knew in advance about 9/11.
Right.
And they were, you know, considered to be suffering from this malady called Bush derangement syndrome. But you did not see those nuts, really, on MSNBC or, you know, taken seriously by the so-called liberal media. By contrast, when those suffering from, and I've got a chapter called Obama derangement syndrome, the birthers, for instance,
just
ridiculously claimed with not a shred of any evidence that he wasn't born in this country, not only were they taken up by the conservative media, but the president was asked on ABC News about it. John Boehner was asked on Meet the Press, did he believe the president was born in this country? So these things that had traditionally been on the fringes of our politics were, in 2011 and 2012, they were thrust to the center of our politics. And, you know, and that was why Obama went home and rummaged through his late mother's possessions and came up with the birth certificate, and then had the Hawaiian authorities release the longer form birth certificate, and he presented it in the press room because, you know, he thought enough is enough. Like, we've got important things to deal with here, and we've got to get this out of the way, even though he believed that it was helping him, that those suffering from Obama derangement syndrome were actually helping him. And indeed, after he released his birth certificate, he ordered that they be emblazoned on T-shirts sold in the Obama online campaign store. And at one point he said, "I want mugs. Where are my mugs?" He knew how to exploit this as well.
It was such a complete and utter waste of time, wasn't it? It just consumed all this valuable time. Just wanted it over. Come on. Come on. You talk about, and we'll go to phone calls after this, there's a part in which you look at his, because we're always trying to figure out who this man is, you talk about his intense racial consciousness that he had nurtured in his own mind since childhood, and it's much more apparent in private than it is in public, that he thinks about this. In public, I'm amazed that he has sort of risen above the fray time and time again when you would think it would drive somebody absolutely crazy to hear all these things being said. Tell me about that private racial consciousness.
Well, you remember that he is the author of Dreams from My Father, and he spent quite a bit of time when he was in his 20s sorting through his racial identity and processing it in ways that I think were, healthy for his development, not to mention making a good book. And so it's always been something that has interested him, but he understood immediately on coming to the presidency that he had to be president of all the people. And so he was not going to be out there talking about race and his racial identity in public very often at all, only quite rarely. But in private, he'd be up in the residence on his iPad seeing what people were writing about him. It wasn't that he was lashing out or anything like that, but clearly he liked it when other people would respond on his behalf. And so if I can just tell a quick story about Stephen Colbert that I think gives you a sense of how he appreciated it when people would stand up for him. So you remember that Donald Trump, who was pushing the birther thing, who was saying some things that were really rather racial, I thought, when he said that he made an offer to Obama in October of 2012, he said, "I will give $3 million to a charity of the president's choice if he releases his birth certificate," which he'd done a year before, "releases his college transcripts," the implication being that he's stupid to have gotten into college, which has its own racial dimension to it. So then a couple days later, Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report says on his show, "I have an offer for Donald Trump. I will give him $1 million from the Colbert Super PAC, for a better tomorrow, if he lets me dip my balls in his mouth, because that's the only way we can be sure that nothing more will come out of it."
Oh, right? My gosh.
So then he says this on his show. So then fast forward after the election, Kennedy Center honors. And in the receiving line, Colbert, who had been there to introduce David Letterman, sees the president and says, "Congratulations on being reelected." And the president says, "Well, maybe it was thanks in part to your super PAC." And Stephen Colbert says, "Well, we can't talk about my super PAC. That would be coordinated." And the president says, "But we can talk about your offer to Donald Trump." And at that point, Michelle Obama comes bounding over and says, "We watched that tape over and over again." And I actually have a picture of that.
It's a great picture in the book. He is just delighted, the president is, isn't he?
So, that gives you a sense of how, even though he couldn't swing at these pitches himself, and I think this was frustrating and continues to be frustrating for a lot of his supporters that he isn't more confrontational. I wish, in 2013 now that he would be more confrontational. He is stepping out a little bit more. But he felt that he would sort of reignite these old racial dynamics of charge and countercharge and who's playing the race card. And he needed to stay away from all that. I think he was wise to stay away from all that. And so while I, you know, I'm critical of him on in several areas, I think the way he has kind of upheld the dignity of the office and the way he has stayed above the fray publicly has generally been smart.
Jonathan Alter is our guest this hour. His book is his new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Here's how you reach us. We'll go to phone calls, I promise, in just a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, that would be A-OK, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls for Jonathan Alter, starting with Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hello?
Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you have to ask the question, you know, why do humans act like this? And I think it's because humans have a will to dominate. I think the will to dominate is the same thing as the will to live. It's a struggle for domination. It's not rational. If you're looking for rationality in a lot of this, you're just not going to find it. It's not really about race, politics, religion, economics, and things like that. I think race is just a social construction. And people invent these things. They differentiate human beings in order to, you know, dominate, assert themselves in the world. And I think the evolutionary brain is afraid of the other, you know, and that's the...
Well, the other is, it's a very important concept that you've raised. You know, the other is very relevant to the conversation that we're having because Barack Obama was such a different president than any that we've
completely
had.
Completely, right.
I think with the exception of Franklin Pierce, maybe one other, there were no other presidents out of, 44 whose names ended in a vowel, much less being named Barack Hussein Obama.
Right.
So this, you know, it's understandable why this pushed a lot of buttons for a lot of people.
Let's talk about the Tea Party for a moment, please, because you do look at this and... I'm wondering how the Tea Party became a social movement, how it worked its way into the political realm, and how perhaps, or maybe you'll say it didn't, it sort of defined the way Republicans governed during Obama's tenure thus far.
Well, when I interviewed the president about the Tea Party in 2009, his explanation, which I thought was pretty good, was that it really started in opposition to the stimulus, which was, you know, a very large piece of legislation that not only was the biggest clean energy bill and the biggest boost for medical and scientific research and 100 other things that we don't need to go over, but it represented a return to Keynesian spending in order to get us out of a very deep hole. And this was something that almost all economists agreed was a good idea, but even conservative economists like Reagan's, when you're losing 800,000 jobs a month, but if you're an older, largely white group of conservatives, which is what the Tea Party was, this, in combination with what we were just discussing, you know, an other as president, was a real shock to the system. And it started, the Tea Party movement started on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade when a reporter for CNBC named Rick Santelli was complaining about how people were being asked to, you know, bail out homeowners, and there should be a Tea Party immediately to protest this. It was kind of ironic because actually the Obama administration was very slow and continues to be slow to bail out homeowners who are in foreclosure. But it ignited something, and so by April 15th, 2009, tax day, there were these, you know, fairly spontaneous rallies all over the country. Now, there was a lot of what's called astroturfing, as opposed to grassroots efforts, money from big conservative organizations, what super well-funded conservative organizations like FreedomWorks, constant coverage on Fox, which actually co-branded with these urban, urban rallies to grow the movement. And it took off very fast. It was a fairly decentralized movement. It was ironic that none of these people had objected to the expansion of the Medicare Part B, the drug prescription program that President Bush put in place without any way to pay for it. And that didn't seem to bother them a few years earlier. But when Obamacare came along, they found it very threatening and identified it as socialism, which it obviously wasn't. And over time, by 2010, something like 40% of the country and vast majority of Republicans had a favorable impression of the Tea Party and almost identified themselves with the Tea Party. Now, that faded over time, but like a lot of social movements, it conditioned our politics in ways that we're still sorting out. So even as the Tea Party brand, you know, which I thought of as old wines, W-H-I-N-E-S, in new bottles, you know, even as that had less of an impact in 2012, there were a lot of Republican House members who were elected with a Tea Party affiliation, and the threat posed by the conservative base and Tea Party elements scares Republican members, and we're of course seeing that still today in the in the immigration debate. But I just want to put it in a little bit more of a current context. People need to understand that something like the Ryan Plan, which doesn't grow out of the Tea Party, but is very, very conservative approach to government that slashes government programs not by the 5 or 10% of the sequestration, but by 30, 40, 50, 60%, a very radical document that, Paul Ryan proposed. This went from being something that was a genuine possibility last year and the year before, if the Republicans were to prevail, as many people expected. Now it's just a fantasy, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm.
It's he can pass it in the House again and again. He can pass the repeal of Obamacare again and again. It doesn't matter. It's all it's all really in the past.
It's over, yeah.
The president has the veto pen, and I think a lot of progressives are suffering from a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder where they forget that, it's time to move on from some of these Tea Party priorities, and the Tea Party is becoming what the Europeans call a remnant party, a minority of a minority.
Let's go to Cynthia from Verona next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, thank you. First, I wanted to thank you, Mr. Alter, for writing The Promise. I hope that with your new book, you'll also be reading the audiobook for it.
Did.
I really appreciated
I did
hearing you tell the story in your own voice.
Thanks.
And my question, since we've acknowledged this lack of communications, especially with regard to the Affordable Care Act, I'm wondering if you've observed any change in the administration, any sort of understanding or acknowledgement of that occurring and any efforts to remedy that.
Yeah, I think there has been some change. I think it started during the campaign, and they began to frame the issue better. They did an excellent job of selling Obamacare to Latino voters in the Spanish-language media, and that was part of a very interesting story that I try to tell of how they got 71% of the Latino vote. And if immigration reform goes through, and I still think, despite the news of this week, that there's a real possibility that it will, it will be because they got 71% of the Latino vote, and that in turn will be because they brought up their game on selling Obamacare, as well as doing a hundred other things, you know, employing the Latina Oprah, whom most Anglo journalists have never heard of.
Right.
You know, Christina Saralegui, who was very, very influential in that community, and some others as well. I hope that they've learned lessons from the flubbing of the sale of Obamacare, but I'm not entirely sure that they have. I don't think they're on their game right now in terms of communicating. So this is an ongoing problem for them. But the thing about President Obama is that you can't count him out. He has a way of rallying when he's back to the wall. Mm-hmm. See this again and again. And, you know, one of the stories that most intrigued me was the way they fought back against voter suppression, mm-hmm. which was an issue in Wisconsin, of course, but in actually all battleground states except for Nevada. So after they won control, not just of the House, but of lots of state legislatures in the 2010 midterms, they moved in 43 states in a concerted effort to suppress the vote of Democratic constituencies. And in 19 states, they actually got legislation through, got bills through that did so. And there was a pitched battle over voter suppression. And in most cases, through a combination of judges and other efforts, it was rebuffed. But you know what happened in Wisconsin, and if for instance, the efforts to make it much harder for students to vote, if that had been successful, if that had prevailed in Wisconsin, it's very possible that Romney would have carried Wisconsin. If he had carried Wisconsin, and a few other battleground states where voter suppression also had to be rebuffed, then he would have been elected. And I try to pull together for the first time all of these strands of the voter suppression story, or what I call the voter suppression project, because it was a concerted effort. I try to pull them all together in one place.
You've also tried to pull together the information, and there isn't very much of it, of how many cases of fraud there have been.
Almost none. So this was a canard. This was a myth that was manufactured. It began after the 2000 election by Karl Rove, kind of launched this, and they advanced it in the Bush Justice Department. And it's not borne out by the facts. Even in the Supreme Court case of Crawford versus Indiana, in which the court ruled that that state ID card laws were constitutional, the plaintiffs in the case provided no examples of vote fraud to bolster their arguments. So they won on other grounds. So the whole idea that there was any significant vote fraud that would necessitate these laws is just completely shitted by the facts. What I tried to do, Kathleen, you know, I mean, people can tell I have a point of view.
Sure.
I think, you know, books should have a point of view. I've never been an Associated Press reporter, you know, but I really tried throughout the book to substantiate what I was saying,
right,
kind of live under the sovereignty of facts,
mm-hmm.
Rather than arguments or, assumptions. And that would apply to some of the assumptions on the left as well,
mm-hmm.
to test them with facts.
Right. It's a substantive book. That's why I call it this. And on a related side note, but having to do with voting, would you say it's beyond the shadow of a doubt that Al Gore won Florida?
Well, that's a whole other conversation, but I will say...
You do include the numbers. Yeah.
I do think that he did win Florida, and for this reason, and the reason that it was relevant to the story of 2012, setting aside the whole question of the people in Palm Beach who thought they were voting for for Gore and voted for Pat Buchanan because of the butterfly ballot, which when I broke that story on election night on NBC News, it was probably the biggest, you know, scoop of my career, not kind of by accident, but that's a whole other story. But setting that aside, a couple of years after 2000, a very careful look by a group of journalists at the purging of voter rolls of so-called felons revealed that several thousand, enough voters to have given the Florida and thus the election to Gore, were wrongly accused of being felons, wrongly stricken from the voter rolls, and actually had not been felons in the first place. So what's interesting and relevant for 2012 is that the Republican lawyer who had been the general counsel of the Republican Party in Florida, a fellow by the name of Bucky Mitchell IV, he had been responsible for the purging of those voter rolls of alleged felons that you could make a good argument tilted the election to Gore. So fast forward 11 years to 2011, and it is Bucky Mitchell IV who writes a statute that then is passed and signed by the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, that essentially makes it impossible to register voters in Florida. And the League of Women Voters actually pulled up stakes and after 100 years left Florida because if this statute was allowed to stay in place, it would have criminalized their voter registration activity if they didn't return their voter registration forms within 48 hours. So there was testimony. I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but this will give you some idea of the sorts of things that I dug up. There was testimony in a criminal case in Florida where Bucky Mitchell IV says in a meeting with other Republicans, we got to get this bill through to hold down the African-American vote. And so there's a very, very explicit evidence of voter suppression in Florida. Now, the courts threw it out, which is what allowed Obama to carry Florida. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had a chance there, and it would have been much harder for him to be elected.
Jonathan Alter is our guest. His new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Let's try and squeeze in a couple more phone calls. Don in West Salem, hi.
Good morning. How are you today?
All right, John. Go ahead, please.
Okay, two things. They made Republicans, whatever, maybe some Democrats made such a big stink about what a terrible thing the IRS did, which is basically something that was done in the IRS like 20, 30 years ago and whatever, ancient history. But what I want to know is why is there not somebody investigating the politicians? It's such a blatant case of bigotry and racism by Republicans and whoever. It seems like there should be some investigating going on.
All right, Jonathan.
Okay, so the caller makes a great point as it applies to the IRS. So, you know, my book ends before the IRS controversies erupted this year. But I do have a little bit in the center holds about a filing that Karl Rove made to the IRS in 2010. A filing in which he claimed that Crossroads GPS, his Super PAC C4, would, quote, not primarily be involved in influencing elections, unquote. This was materially false. And like a lot of other filings by super PACs of the right and, I have to say, of the left as well, they were claiming that they were social welfare organizations and not political organizations. And they all deserve to be investigated by the IRS. So the problem with this situation is partly that it should have been a little bit more even. There should have been more liberal groups that were investigated and not just Tea Party groups. But the bigger problem is that the IRS let these organizations get away with murder, get away with misrepresenting what their purpose was. And, you know, as we know, you know, Karl Rove's organization went on to spend $70 million. To say that they were not primarily intending to influence elections was just simply untrue. And there were many other conservative and some liberal organizations that made similar such misrepresentations to the IRS in order to get a tax exemption. And they all very much deserve, as the caller said, to be investigated.
Thanks, John, very much for the call. Let's just go to briefly to a couple of other things. There's so much in the book. The First Family has a little book club. They're reading Catcher in the Rye and American classics. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, give people a little bit of a sense of what went on inside the White House when there aren't people around. this is something that they do for their daughters. They read American classics together, and my understanding is they're still doing it.
That's nice. The president had one meeting and one only with Rupert Murdoch.
Yes. Yeah. That was in 2008, and it did not go well, mostly because of Roger Ailes's presence there. He and Murdoch got along okay, but when Ailes came in the room, he started flinging these accusations and that Obama didn't appreciate, and Obama complained about Sean Hannity calling him a socialist every night, and the meeting deteriorated some. So I do try to give people a sense of, you know, who Obama was seeing, and in some cases, who he wasn't. I was very surprised, for instance, to find out that the Obamas and the Clintons didn't have a dinner with just the four of them at the White House until the second term.
That is amazing.
But a lot of people, I have direct accounts of the president's meetings with African-American leaders, with Latino leaders, and some of his back and forth with them is quite interesting. It wasn't smooth sailing at all. He had a spat with Cornel West and also one with Luis Gutierrez from Chicago about his slowness in moving toward immigration reform.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are these stories, I hope, have a lot of texture, Kathleen. And you know, this is really intended for people who know a lot about politics but are ready to, learn things that they didn't know because they haven't come out before.
Yeah, I love that description. That's indeed what it does. you asked the question, let's end on this, because take it in the largest sense of the word, and it has to do with the way he governs. You asked the question, what would happen, and I wonder on many fronts, what would happen if the president were more of a schmoozer?
Yeah, this is a kind of a tool that he leaves in the toolbox too often. I think he's trying to change now, and he's playing golf with Republican senators more often and that kind of thing. To me, it's a little more. I'm not sure that there's any particular bill that he would have necessarily gotten through if he was more of a schmoozer. But if you're a Democratic senator, it's really hard to go back to Wisconsin or some other state and your constituents say, "Well, when's the last time you talked to the president?" And if you go, months ago,
right.
You know, it doesn't really look very good for them, and they need to feel the love a little bit more from him. I try to explore why he's not more of a schmoozer, why he separates what he considers to be his real friends from his fake friends. Part of it is he wasn't raised in a way that made him needy. He's always been very secure himself.
Mm-hmm.
The neediness of other people is an abstraction to him.
Hmm.
And politicians, like people in show business or CEOs, they're often very insecure and needy, and this is one of the reasons that got them, one of the things that got them to the top. And he got to the top in other ways and doesn't fully relate to that. But I try in the center hold to, whether it's the president or Scott Prudy, who is the bartender who changed history, who who, you know, videotaped Mitt Romney's 11% comments, you know, or...
we have about 10 Foster seconds.
Freeze, a super PAC billionaire that I got to know. I want to know the human dimension.
Yeah.
The stories behind politics. So that's what I tried to do.
Jonathan, thank you so much. It's a book of great substance and a terrific read. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was a pleasure.
Jonathan Alter, the book is The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies. It has just been published. And for those of you who like politics and the backstory, it's worth your time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Great conversations ahead.